Dewey fitted a key into the front door of the Clutter House. Inside, the house was warm, for the heat had not been turned off, and the shiny floored rooms, smelling of a lemon-scented polish, seemed only temporarily untenanted. It was as though today were Sunday and the family might at any moment return from church. The heirs, Mrs. English and Mrs. Jarchow, had removed a vanload of clothing and furniture, yet the atmosphere of a house still humanly inhabited had not thereby been diminished. In the parlor, a sheet of music, Coming Through the Rye, stood open on the piano rack. In the hall, a sweat-stained gray Stetson hat, Herb's, hung on a hat peg. Upstairs in Kenyon's room, on a shelf above his bed, the lenses of the dead boy's spectacles gleamed with reflected light. The detective moved from room to room. He had toured the house many times. Indeed, he went out there almost every day, and in one sense could be said to find these visits pleasurable. For the place, unlike his own home, or the sheriff's office with its hullabaloo, was peaceful. The telephones, their wires still severed, were silent. The great quiet of the prairies surrounded him. He could sit in Herb's parlor rocking chair and rock and think. A few of his conclusions were unshakable. He believed that the death of Herb Clutter had been the criminal's main objective, the motive being a psychopathic hatred, or possibly a combination of hatred and thievery, and he believed that the commission of the murders had been a leisurely labor, with perhaps two or more hours elapsing between the entrance of the killers and their exit. The coroner, Dr. Robert Fenton, reported an appreciable difference in the body temperatures of the victims, and, on this basis, theorized that the order of execution had been Mrs. Clutter, Nancy, Kenyon, and Mr. Clutter. Attendant upon these beliefs was his conviction that the family had known very well the persons who destroyed them. During this visit, Dewey paused at an upstairs window, his attention caught by something seen in the near distance, a scarecrow amid the wheat stubble. The scarecrow wore a man's hunting cap and a dress of weather-faded flowered calico. Surely an old dress of Bonnie Clutter's? Wind frolicked the skirt and made the scarecrow sway, made it seem a creature forlornly dancing in the cold December field. And Dewey was somehow reminded of Marie's dream. One recent morning she had served him a bungled breakfast of sugared eggs and salted coffee, then blamed it all on a silly dream, but a dream the power of daylight had not dispersed. "It was so real, Alvin," she said. "As real as this kitchen. That's where I was, here in the kitchen. I was cooking supper, and suddenly Bonnie walked through the door. She was wearing a blue Angora sweater, and she looked so sweet and pretty. And I said, 'Oh, Bonnie, Bonnie dear, I haven't seen you since that terrible thing happened.' But she didn't answer, only looked at me in that shy way of hers, and I didn't know how to go on under the circumstances. So I said, 'Honey, come see what I'm making Alvin for his supper. A pot of gumbo with shrimp and fresh crabs. It's just about ready. Come on, honey, have a taste.' But she wouldn't. She stayed by the door looking at me. And then, I don't know how to tell you exactly, but she shut her eyes. She began to shake her head very slowly and wring her hands very slowly and to whimper or whisper. I couldn't understand what she was saying, but it broke my heart. I never felt so sorry for anyone, and I hugged her. I said, 'Please, Bonnie. Oh, don't, darling, don't. If ever anyone was prepared to go to God, it was you, Bonnie.' But I couldn't comfort her. She shook her head and wrung her hands, and then I heard what she was saying. She was saying, 'To be murdered. To be murdered. No, No. There's nothing worse. Nothing worse than that. Nothing.